Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Day. I am your host, the extremely under the weather Jeff Bowdrin. You know, we don't miss a fucking show here, but sometimes we do it while we're sick. So, Barry, this is going to be one of these let's get this thing in the can and get it over with shows. How you doing, buddy?
Those are my favorite, Jeff. When we can do it, we can say, let's just fucking go home and we'll take care of this. But I'm sorry, Jeff, we are now, what, 77? Is that right?
78.
70 fucking 8 shows, and I said this before, through sickness, Jeff, and you are pretty sick too, knowing this for a fact. You're pretty sick. I almost thought I'm going to have to ride solo, but you somehow chicken souped it, penicillined it, whatever, you're here. That's amazing.
No, it was actually more like, I don't want you to get all the glory of your podcast.
I'm a glory hog. For my podcast, I'm a glory hog.
That's what I heard on another podcast. You referred to it as your podcast.
Jeff, did you really? There's not a chance in hell you vested that 3 hours to listen to me because I buried it in the middle. And I know that didn't happen, but Jeff, through
five-hour podcaster, the things I love to listen to.
Through sicknesses, through weddings, vacations, traveling, you name it, we haven't missed a goddamn week, Jeff. I'll tell you, when these podcast awards ever come out, certainly, there's a few awards we could get. None of them positive, but we should get an award for the guys who at least always show up, right?
Better get at least fucking nominated. That's all I got to say.
That's it.
On this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on sickness. We're going to break kayfabe on, things like sports, movies, television, wrestling, life. I don't know. Kids going to college. Barry, I think you took a trip to Pittsburgh. How'd that go?
That went extremely well. So yesterday was Admitted Students Day. So my son has been accepted to four of his choices so far, which is great. So we spent Friday, Saturday, and came home this morning from University of Pittsburgh. I love Pittsburgh, Jeff. I had, up until about a year ago, I had never been there, and I didn't know shit about Pittsburgh. And I got to tell you, if I knew anything about Pittsburgh, it probably, I guess, I had a preconceived notion. It was negative. I wasn't, you know, why would I want to go? I think this is like the greatest town ever. I absolutely love Pittsburgh. I love the people. I love the food. I love everything about Pittsburgh. And then next week we make our trip to Penn State. And at that point on the car ride home, my son will have all the balls in his court. Did I just say all the balls? I did, but he'll have all the balls in his court. Exactly. And he will decide where he is going to college, which for me is very exciting. It's my first child going off to college, so I'm very excited about it. It'll be interesting to see exactly where he's going to choose. It really has come down. Is it going to be in the state of Pennsylvania, which is State College, Penn State, or Pittsburgh, or is it going to be going to Washington, D.C., admitted to both American and George Washington universities there? So it is now up to him. He decides where he's going to go to college. And then I have to somehow come up with the amount of money to pay the college tuitions.
Well, there is that. Well, the brothership will wait with bated anticipation for the big announcement. So speaking of announcements, going to just put this out there, nip this in the proverbial bud, as they say, Barry. So this week, folks, we got not one, not two. Yes, actually, two interviews for you today, two pretty special interviews. And because of time limitations, because we don't want to be a 5-hour podcast like some that Barry are on, we kind of nip the old movie of the week and match of the week just for this week only. Next week, we will have them back on the show as regular. So those of you that have submitted your reviews, don't worry. They're going to be on next week. We're just going to kill it for this week because of our two special interviews. Barry, how about the fact we're going to go with from Athens, Georgia? Where's Athens, Georgia? Well, that's the home of the University of Georgia, the Bulldogs. Who played for the University of Georgia that was in wrestling? No, not fucking Goldberg. I'm talking Dan Spivey. Dan Spivey, how cool is that, Bear?
It's super cool. And it's another thing, too. When the nominations come up, are there such a thing as podcast nominations and podcast awards? Because there should be at this point. But our lineup of talent that we've had for interviews here is pretty unfucking believable. So, yeah, I'm a Dan Spivey fan, too. I'm a Waylon Mercy fan. And sadly, I think his body was kind of broken down by that point, and he couldn't really flesh the character out. But I just thought it was super cool, and it's awesome. You know, we've had Dan Spivey. Jeff, who's our other guest this week?
Well, you know, you may have heard of him. He's a bad man from Borger, Texas. The man they call the Lariat. Boom! Stan fucking Hansen. How cool is that of a get?
Wow. That's a huge get right there, too.
So now you understand why the match of the week and the movie of the week got preempted a week, because we got two pretty special guests coming up this week, and we wanted to talk to them and get some of their thoughts. You know, so cool talking to Stan Hansen, who I've had a chance to talk to at a dinner once before, but just a great guy, great guest.
Yeah, super excited, too. And he's Stan Hansen, the babysitter, is all I'll say. That's
yes.
The new name. Larry, has gone by. It is now called Stan the Babysitter Hansen.
Grandpa Stan, they call him now. So.
Grandpa Stan.
So before
Stan
we go,
he's going to hit you with the lariat.
Before we go into that, as the date of this recording, this is Sunday, and yesterday we lost someone very important to the wrestling community. You know, one of the things about wrestling is that a lot of marriages come and go by the wayside. Yours truly included, but one that stuck around for the long term and the long haul were Terry and Vicky Funk, and we lost Vicky Funk yesterday. And Barry, yeah, you just got to feel for the Funker. You know, that's got to be like losing your right arm or your right leg, just someone that's been a part of your life that long.
Yeah, absolutely. She had a so they were together 55 years, I think. Now, there was a period where they separated and divorced, and I think in a testament to true love, they actually remarried. And that really right there says it all, that, you know, when you can divorce and you get back together, that truly does signify true love. So, you know, Terry he's got a reputation. He has slowed down over the last couple of years, but Terry had a reputation as a wild man. It was a well-earned reputation, and Vicky was the lady that kept him on the straight and narrow as best that she could. She was the rock, and you know, it's very sad. I only got the chance to meet her once, but, you know, if you knew Terry, and I don't know Terry personally like that, but if you knew Terry, you knew Vicky. You know, that's the common denominator with that. And I think a lot of people are really concerned now for Terry. You know, that was something that I was able to pick up yesterday. And that a lot of people are concerned. How is Terry at this age? And Terry has his own pretty serious health issues, you know, going the last few years. And how is Terry going to be able to handle this? So my heart goes out to him. You know, we've spoken at great length about how we both feel about Terry Funk. And truly, the wrestling community just absolutely loves Terry Funk. So it's devastating, in a lot of ways. And it's, you know, as we get older, this shit really sucks.
Yes, and as we are wont to do here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of Vicky Funk. We're thinking of the Funker today and hoping that he will get some comfort from all the people that are reaching out to him, supporting him and showing their love to him and for the love that he had for his wife, Vicky. So, okay, Barry, now it's time to go to our CWF Angles segment. I think we're doing number 213 this week or something like that. So this week, Barry, we're going to be talking about, we're going to go in the Wayback Machine. We're going back to the 60s. We're talking Greg Good time here. Well, maybe even before Greg Good. That's how old this was. We are talking about the angle between Boris the Great Malenko and Johnny Valentine. Barry, why don't you give us a little background on that one?
Yeah, too. And I think Greg was only like in his 50s at this stage.
I think so. Yeah.
Still
had a full head of hair. The full mane.
I don't believe between you and I, I've never seen Greg Good or a photo of Greg Good with a full head of hair. So you tell me if that exists, Jeff, you know, but I've never seen that. But Johnny Valentine and the Great Malenko. So really what makes this angle great, Jeff, and this one came in at number 25 on the top 25, is that you've got two legendary heels. So you've got the Great Malenko, who first came to the state 1962, and he had this unprecedented run in Florida for 9 years. And he spent a little time in Texas, and I believe he was in the Mid-Atlantic area, but he kind of did what Kevin Sullivan did in the 80s. He would leave for a little bit, and then he would come back, and he would be the top heel again. And I think this was done to keep him fresh. But for the most part, he was a homesteader. This was 9 years in CWF as the top heel. And Johnny Valentine is, to me, everybody talks about Johnny Valentine with, the famous quote, you may not believe wrestling's real, but I can make you believe I'm real, or whatever it was, something I'm paraphrasing with that. But Johnny Valentine was a guy, Jeff, that had his last match in Florida in 1975, which was the same year that he had the plane crash in the Carolinas. Do you know what year he started working in the state of Florida? 1949.
Wow, I was gonna guess
mid-50s. 26 years, and he was on top. He was on top in 49. He was on top in 75. So, I mean, to me, that's unprecedented. And this wasn't like a mercy thing either, where we're going to take a guy with a great rep and still push him. This was a guy that could still go after 26 years of his first match. So you put these two guys together, and I believe Valentine at this stage was the Florida champion. If he wasn't, he had just lost it. He had been a champion throughout, in Florida for years. But you put these two together, and it's really – you've got the greatest heel in CWF history and the great Malenko, and another guy who's pretty close to being one of the great heels in CWF history. What a team this makes. And it's a team that is – there's a lot of differences there, as far as their style of wrestling. But psychologically, maybe the two greatest of all times as far as being a heel, because these two – knew how to work the crowd and how to work the arenas. But basically two legendary heels who formed a legendary tag team. Malenko turns on Johnny Valentine, making JV the baby. Those who saw it say the crowd reactions were possibly the best ever. So again, Jeff, you and I were a little too young to be there. But people like Greg Good were there and some other people were there. Greg Good has a great comment. He goes, 25? Barry, you pulled too many youngsters. As a kid, this was Frankenstein versus Dracula. I couldn't see JV as a babyface, simply two monsters going at it. The split totally had me marking out to the nth degree. Classic. And this is, the sad thing is there's no footage of this. Of all this footage that is appearing on YouTube currently, there's nothing out there. And what I would kill to see 1960s CWF. We're lucky now. There's 70s out there. There's plenty of 80s that's out there, but nothing in the 60s. And I've got a videotape. It's maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and I believe it came from Don Curtis, and it has some 60s on it, but it's clipping. So it's got Malenko versus Graham, and I think it's 13 seconds. Like it's just real brief snippets of, and it really isn't a good look at it, but, what I would kill to have it. My comments, what happens when you pair two of professional wrestling's greatest and most respected heels in the legendary great Malenko and Johnny Valentine? A great breakup, of course. While before my time, sadly, this was one of those angles that people were still talking about years later. And I've mentioned this, Jeff, previously. The beauty of professional wrestling wasn't always what was taking place in the ring. It was the experience of going to a place like the Miami Beach Convention Center every Wednesday night, seeing the same fans, getting the same popcorn, going to the same vendor, seeing the same guy who sells the programs, and doing this year in and year out. And part of the beauty was being able to be a little kid, which I was, and I had hair at that time, and being able to sit ringside and have these old timers who still dressed the part. There was this guy, Jimmy, which I've talked about, and Jimmy would come in a suit. He would wear a suit, a black suit, white shirt, and a black tie every week. And it was just so cool. And they would sit there and they would talk about angles. And it was funny because they were us before you and I were us. And when I say that, they would complain about current wrestling, meaning the mid-1970s, which I thought was great, right? They would complain about that as being showboaty. And I think specifically Dusty Rhodes, where Dusty was much more of a show. But they would talk about guys like Eddie Graham, the great Malenko, and Johnny Valentine in these hushed, revered tones, like it was a legitimate sport When Dusty Rhodes came around, it was showboating, it was an elbow, it was theatrics. But when the great Malenko and Johnny Valentine locked up, that was real, and you better sit down and watch. And it was so cool because I would sit there and you would get this education from people that had actually seen it, and I absorbed all of it. So, you know, some 40, 45 years later, I have all these. I can't tell you what I did 3 days ago, but I can tell you when I sat ringside and guys like Jimmy and Sal would talk about old school CWF, and they would talk about guys like Johnny Valentine and the great Malenko.
Well, you know, as you were sitting there pontificating, I was thinking about the, believe it or not, the Mike and the Mechanics song, The Living Years, about how every generation blames the one before. And that's really true. You know, you and I sit there and a lot of times we talk about how much better wrestling was in the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, now there's a whole generation of fans that thinks, you know, today's product is so superior to what was going on 30 years ago. And, you know, we just, of course, can't understand that mindset, that, you know, way of thinking. So, you know, the one thing when I think back about Johnny Valentine and, you know, I remember, I think it was episode 2 or 3, my friend John Hitchcock was on. And I remember John talking about Johnny Valentine because he revered him so much. And, you know, the one thing that he expressed to me without saying this word specifically is what a minimalist Johnny Valentine was. You know, he had everything he did had meant something. It had a purpose, you know? And I think you had told me about this, or maybe it was Greg, that when the turn between Malenko and Valentine happened, that Valentine was looking to the crowd, you know, in the way that he would do that for a reaction. And the crowd was like reaching out, wanting to turn him. And there was this moment when he raised his arm, and just raising his arm, the crowd just popped huge because they had waited so long. And that was Johnny's way of saying, okay, I'm accepting that you're behind me, you know, and just the way that he would allow guys to lay in the shots. And he expected you to do that because he was going to do that to you. And, you know, Johnny Valentine, let's be honest, we've heard some stories, was kind of a strange guy, but he made you believe what you were watching. It might as well have been a UFC event, you know, what you were watching. That's how stiff he wanted it to be and how much he wanted the fans at ringside to believe that what they were watching was real.
Yeah, and that's a really good – and here's the thing with Johnny Valentine. So he went out on top, and I don't know how old he was in 75. My assumption is he was probably close to that 50-year mark, maybe 48, 49, 50, somewhere right around there. How many more years could Johnny Valentine have gone? I don't know if he could have transitioned, obviously, into the 80s based off of the switch of, you know, his style of wrestling and his look versus what we got, which is the Road Warriors, Hulk Hogan, and that whole deal. But I think he could have continued into the late 70s and possibly early 80s. And I say that because we saw Buddy Rogers in Florida in 1979, and he was 58 years old. And granted, it wasn't, you know, Buddy Rogers was essentially hidden in 6- and 8-man tag team matches. And he would come out, he would throw a couple of punches, do a drop kick, and then maybe go for a figure four or something. But he wasn't, you know, he wasn't out there having 20-minute matches. Valentine could. So Valentine conceivably, while younger, was in better shape. And I just wonder, like, could he still have been a force in 1979, where he would have been in his, you know, early to mid-50s? I just don't see him slowing down based on what we saw in 75. So psychologically, and I know what you're talking about because I think Greg relayed that to me at one point as well, because this made such an impact on him. But I think Johnny Valentine could have continued to go, and it would have been cool. It's one of those what-ifs, you know, what if Bruiser Brody had lived? You know, it'll always be one of these big what-ifs to us. But, you know, just a tremendous, tremendous guy as a wrestler. You know, the stories are out there, Jeff. I think we've talked about peeing in the ice machines and the fecal matter smeared all over hotel walls, et cetera. So an unusual guy, but at the same time, did anyone ever understand the psychology of professional wrestling the way that Johnny Valentine did? I'm not sure. I'm not sure there's anybody else like him in professional wrestling.
Well, you know, again, as I was sitting here, a name suddenly popped into my head. If we want to give people that are of a younger generation than you and I an idea of what Johnny Valentine was like. All you have to do is look over to the rings of New Japan, Minoru Suzuki, and what he's doing now. And he's in his late 40s. Yeah. But people still believe that Minoru Suzuki is this guy you just don't want to mess with. And he can look at you in the crowd and completely have you wetting your pants because he's that effective in his, you know, in his character, you know. And I think that's a lot of what Johnny Valentine conveyed to the fans also. So, all right. Good stuff, Barry. We'll be looking at another angle next week. So how about now? It's time for us to, you know, we've held back the reins long enough. It's time for us to go to one of our interviews. And first of all, Barry, we're going to go and talk to Dan Spivey. Dan Spivey, of course, as Barry mentioned, was Waylon Mercy, was one half of the Skyscrapers with a young man named Mark Callis, who he went on to a bit of fame after that. But first, he was teaming up with a guy named Sid Vicious, and he gave us some thoughts on Sid Vicious. So why don't we go to an interview right now with Dan Spivey? And we are very happy to be joined here tonight by Dan Spivey, Barry, one of the original Skyscrapers, and Waylon Mercy. I, of course, fondly remember Dan for his time in All Japan, teaming with Stan Hansen, but a true legend, Barry. How about that?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, too. You know, we've had some really fantastic guests over the last 6 or 7 months, from Butch Reed, Tully Blanchard, Bob Roop. You know, it seems like every week we've got somebody. And how fortunate this week. So we've got a guy, Jeff, and I don't know if you know this, but apparently Dan was trained by Dusty Rhodes in Tampa. And Dan, so tell us a little bit about that, the great Dusty Rhodes. And I grew up in Miami Beach. So I grew up going to see wrestling every Wednesday night on the beach. I was in Tampa as I got a little bit older a bunch of times. But, you know, Dusty was a god back in those days. So, the story that I read that Dusty somehow discovered you and then trained you. Is that correct?
Well, Dusty, to be totally honest about it, I met Dusty in a country western bar and got to know him from being in there. They used to come in there after matches on Tuesday night or something. Like, I've always been a fan of wrestling. I was just a huge mark. And, and Dusty had asked me if I was interested in becoming a wrestler, and I said, sure. And so Dusty gave me, you know, the first opportunity to, you know, to get into professional wrestling. Actually, Barry Windham trained me and Scott Hall. Dusty, I guess, had met Scott somewhere and came up with an idea to call us the American Starship. Where he got that name, I don't know. Eagle and Coyote. And right after Dusty had brought us in, Dusty got the job in Charlotte for Crockett Promotions. And so me and Scott followed Dusty up there. They didn't have a ring up there in Charlotte for some reason. They didn't have a facility for it. They did their TVs on Tuesday night in different little towns. And so they had the ring set up early at the arenas, you know, but sometimes, you know, everybody be coming in, you couldn't train, you know, in front of the audience. So, you know, it was hard. And, but I became friends with Ricky Steamboat. And actually, Ricky is the first guy I ever suplexed and drop kicked. And Ricky would go down early in these TV shows that we would do on Tuesdays, and he would work out with me. For some reason, Scott didn't come or whatever, but Ricky is the one to, you know, really help me a lot.
That's a pretty good trainer if you're going to have someone train with you.
Yeah, man, what a talent he is.
So you said you grew up as a wrestling fan. Who exactly did you were you into when you were growing up as a kid?
Dusty.
Yeah.
Dusty was the guy. You know, the Briscoes were awesome. You know, there was the Funks were awesome. They came in there quite a bit. And Harley Race, gosh, there was so much talent that came through Florida and championship wrestling, and, you know, Gordon Solie doing the TV. It was quite interesting, you know, and Eddie Graham was probably the first one to really, you know, caught my attention. Him and the Great Malenko had some awesome battles.
Oh, so you were watching going back to like the 1960s then, because Malenko and Eddie Graham had these massive like Russian chain matches, with just bloodbaths taking place throughout the state. So you grew up really in the heyday of that. But here's the irony: is that you never actually worked for CWF, though, correct?
No, not during the heyday, or not, you know, I never worked in the Army on Tuesday night, never got that opportunity. And that's the place where all the history was in Tampa as far as wrestling.
So I just wanted to ask you, I know that you played ball at UGA. You played under Coach Vince Dooley, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. And how was your time in Georgia? I know you ended up blowing out a knee. I believe it was your junior or senior year. I'm sure you look back fondly under Coach Dooley, playing under him, though.
I didn't get along with Coach Dooley.
Oh, well, okay, you know, then.
But I'll elaborate on that story. I mean, you know, he wasn't a very friendly guy. You could be walking down the hallway, and he's going to walk right past you. He wouldn't even say hello to you. He was a real asshole of a guy. I tried to leave my sophomore year, and one of the guys, I guess a couple of guys, called the defensive coordinator. His name was Herc Russell.
Oh, yeah.
What a guy he was. Yeah, man, he was a hell of a guy. And they promised me when I came up there that I'd play on defense, and they had me on offense. And I was just pissed, and I was going to go back and go to the University of Tampa. And Coach Russell blocked me in where I couldn't get out. And he pulled his truck up right behind me, and I couldn't get out. And he started unloading my truck, my car and stuff. So I stayed there because of Herc Russell. That's the only reason I stayed at Georgia. And the other thing is that Georgia was the only one that took my college entrance exam for me. So that's why I went there.
That always helps.
Yeah, it did. I could have gone anywhere. And if anybody out there is listening that has, anybody that's thinking about or lucky enough to get a scholarship, go to a school where you're going to grow up. You know, I have all my contacts and everything up in Athens and around Atlanta and stuff. And, you know, I've always lived in Tampa. So, you know, but back then, the University of Florida didn't have any white guys on the team. Not that that really mattered. It's just that when I was recruited by Florida, I went up there, and all the black guys gave me nothing but a ration of shit. And I said, well, I'm not going there. And Georgia, you know, was all white. And Miami was a renegade school back then. And Florida State had won a game in 2 years. They were 0-18-2. And they were having practices under chicken wire, 10-foot holes and stuff. It was, you know, it was crazy. So I went to Georgia. My best friend went to Georgia the year before. So that's how I ended up in Georgia.
And, of course, later in your career, your UGA affiliation status hooked you up with the varsity club, which a lot of people remember you being a part of that with guys like Doc and with Mike Rotundo and with Kevin Sullivan. I'm sure you got to remember those days kind of fondly because you guys were really over.
Yeah, Steiner brothers were involved. You know, after Georgia, I got hurt up there, and I still went to the Jets. A lot of people don't know that. I don't know why, but I went to the Jets after Georgia. Wasn't there long. You know, that's what NFL stands for, not for long. But got hurt.
were you there? Were you there with Coach Eubank, or the year that Lou Holtz was there?
Lou Holtz. He lasted 11 games. He made it a little bit longer than I did.
Yeah.
But yeah, later on, you know, when I got into wrestling, we got the varsity club. You know, that was something that, you know, could have got over really good, but for some reason or another, they didn't push it. So.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
And all of us were, you know, all of us were legitimate, you know.
Sure.
Letterman. So, you know, that was not many people. I mean, there was quite a few of us, you know.
Yeah, and definitely, and prior to Waylon Mercy, which we'll get to Waylon Mercy because, you know, it's funny, but if you follow any form of wrestling on social media, people still refer to Waylon Mercy and the beauty. And even though it was short-lived, you know, it didn't really go too far, you were aces in that role. And people still talk about it to this day. And obviously, I think the obvious is that people point out and say the Bray Wyatt character evolved from what you were doing with Waylon Mercy. But you had some great tag team partners. And I know that Jeff is really going to want to talk about Stan Hansen, but you teamed with Mike Rotundo, and you teamed with Sid Vicious, Mark Calloway, and obviously actually Stan Hansen. So how was it transitioning? Because even Sid and The Undertaker, Mark Calloway, two very different guys, two very different styles. And I believe Sid had an injury, if it was a punctured lung, if I recall correctly. That was the switch there. But you guys were just, I mean, the skyscrapers in WCW at that time were just fantastic.
Yeah, and they never gave us a push. You know, it's just really really strange why they never did that. You know, Sid had this mysterious injury. It was in New York, and we were working against Scott and Rick Steiner. And I started the match, and, 10 minutes into the match, I go to tag him in. He comes to get in the ring, and no one touched him. He's just coming into the ring, and he punctured a lung. I don't know how in the hell that happened. So I ended up getting
that's not easy to do.
No, I mean, was Sid could do it. I mean, he was brittle. I mean, you guys saw the leg that he broke TV. I mean, that was, you know, his body just couldn't handle his size, I guess. But, you know, that night I got suplexed all over the place because I did the whole match. And you know, the Steiner brothers are Suplex City. So it was a long night for me that night.
So one of the questions we wanted to ask you, Barry actually sent me a note about it the other day. I'm sure you've been asked about this before. The famous squash match that you and Sid had on WCW, where apparently one of the guys decided that he was a bigger star than you two were. Do you remember that match?
Yeah, of course I do. It was horrible. Horrible. I mean, the guy was getting up before I could get up. I mean, it was just horrible. I should have hurt him a lot worse than I did.
Yeah, I think you sent him a bit of a receipt after the match, though, didn't you?
Yeah, of course I did. that was just uncalled. I never had anybody do that before. You know, I was really caught off guard by it all. And, you know, what the hell? You know, at one point during the match, this guy runs into Sid and knocks him on his ass. I was, oh, God. So, you know, it was a horrible deal.
Gotcha. So what was the difference in teaming with somebody like Sid versus somebody like Mark Calloway? And obviously Sid, you know, brittle and the injury, and Sid does have a reputation where, you know, the reputation that Mark Calloway has is really straight. But what was the difference in teaming with those two guys?
You know, you're dealing with two different guys. I mean, they were both green when they came to me, and, you know, they did quite well after they left me. Like everybody did. So,
right. Like my ex-wife, actually, Danny. <That's
right>. Yeah, you know, Sid had this awesome look. I mean, you know, he made all this money just because of his look. You know, the guy doesn't have, you know, I don't mean, I'm just telling the truth. The guy, you know, couldn't even run the ropes good, you know, but he looked great. He really did. And Mark, on the other hand, was an athlete. Mark played basketball. You know, he had a lot of agility. He could walk the ropes, and which was impressive. You know, I knew Mark was going to be a star, and he was really good about listening. And, you know, Sid had his own opinions about how to do things, you know. But Mark was, you know, he was a good partner. He really was. And I think he's one of the best big men that ever worked in the business. Great gimmick, and he worked it. Really, I can't say enough good things about Mark Calloway.
There were a lot of guys that were getting over at that point in time because they look good, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, Diesel was a partner for a while, and Scott Hall, of course, you know, was a partner for a while. And Rotundo, I had some good partners.
Well, let me ask you about one of your other partners that you didn't mention there, and that's your time in All Japan with Stan Hansen. How did you enjoy working in Japan, and not just so much teaming with Stan, but going over and working for Giant Baba and doing all those tours over there? Did you enjoy that, or was it sort of a means to an end? What did you think?
No, I mean, you know, it's a funny story of how that happened. I got let loose. Vince let me loose, and it was like 95 or 96. And I was unemployed. I owed the government a lot of money on back taxes. I had no idea what I was going to do, and sat at home for about 3 weeks. And Terry Funk called me, which I got to know Terry at WWF back then. And he said, "Spivey, how would you like to go to Japan?" I said, "I'd love to." You know, I didn't know much about it at all. You know, I just knew I might have a job opportunity. And so he calls me back and he says, "Spivey," he says, "I got you $3,500 a week, But I told them you were such a good kid that you would settle for three. So I went to Japan, and, you know, they have put all the gaijins, Americans, Europeans, everybody's a gaijin if you're not Japanese. They put us on this bus, and no one on the bus has ever been to Japan before. I think the Rock and Roll Express was on there. Billy, Jesse Funk, I don't know what his name was. Anyway, there's no
Jesse Barr.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, so we didn't know our way around or, you know, didn't know what, you know. And the first night in, I had Rip Rogers as a partner. He's working a gay gimmick. And they put us up against the two top Japanese over there. And they beat hell out of us, man. And it didn't take me long to smarten up what was going on. So, you know, I love Japan. You know, it was no politics involved when I was there. They, you know, took you on your ability, what you could do in the ring. No gimmicks. There wasn't any gimmicks. There wasn't no politics. It was straight up, you know, 80% real. I mean, as long as you didn't break any bones and didn't draw blood on somebody, you know, it was good. You know, things, you know, really looked real. And they were. I mean, as far as chair shots and all this stuff, it was hard. I wish I had spent my whole career there and never came back to the States.
I know you guys had a number of matches with Steve Williams and Terry Gordy that were just fantastic.
Yeah, those guys were a pleasure to work with. And I know everybody there was top hand. I mean, you know, from the beginning match to the end, everybody was a top hand there. And it was really it probably took some years off my career because of the physical part of it, but it was awesome. And the Japanese people are awesome. They treated me great. I should have never left.
So it's been said before that Giant Baba was maybe the most honorable promoter in the history of professional wrestling. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, no doubt. That didn't take long. I mean, Vince has been good to me. I've taken up for Vince on the internet, but, you know, lawsuits and stuff. I don't know if you guys ever saw me and Billy Jack go at it about that, but, you know, Vince was good to me too. But Giant Baba by far was awesome. Man, you know, that's for sure.
Yeah, people have always said guys like Paul Bosch in the U.S. was a real Sam Munchnick, really stand-up guys, but you always hear Giant Baba, you know, put on this upper tier of a guy that, you know, he did everything on a handshake, and if he promised you something, he would live up to it, but he expected the same from you. So, you know, a lot of respect to him, obviously. So let's talk about Waylon Mercy. Jeff, are you a fan of the Waylon Mercy character?
Well, let me ask you before we start talking about that, did they have you look at Max Cady and Cape Fear to get ideas, or was that something that was presented in a different way? How exactly did they come up with a character for you?
It was, you know, we were trying to find a character. They wanted me to come in, but, you know, we were trying to find a gimmick for Dan Spivey. And that's the first time I ever had a gimmick in the skyscrapers, you know. But, and even then I was Dan Spivey. But, you know, and since I'm from the South and everything, the Max Cady deal was Southern, you know, and so we just touched on that and told Vince about it, and he said, well, let's go with it. And so we did, and I just kind of winged it, you know, from watching the movie. I watched the movie several times, getting ideas, and of course putting it in my own words and my own character. We started out with the vignettes, and the vignettes really got over good. You know, it was a time when everybody was screaming and yelling, you know, on their interviews and stuff, and Max Cady or, you know, Waylon just talked to you, you know, very sinister and real low. And so you had to pay attention to what he was saying or you wouldn't hear him. And it really got people's attention. You know, the vignettes did really well. You know, it was a tough time, you know, and the WWF's business at that time, they weren't doing that well. But anyway, that's how the character came about.
Well, since we're both big movie fans, go ahead, Barry.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, so better actor, Robert De Niro or Al Pacino, Dan? Who would you go with?
Robert De Niro.
There you go.
So I was going to ask you a movie question too. So did you see only the Robert De Niro Cape Fear, or did you look at the Robert Mitchum Cape Fear also, the original?
I watched both of them.
Yeah. Which one did you like better?
Robert De Niro.
Okay. So yeah, that
they were both good though. I mean, and they both played the part well.
Come out wherever you are.
Excuse me?
I said, come out wherever you are. That was De Niro's line from the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
So go ahead, Bear.
Yeah, so it was a pretty cool thing. So after you left the WWE, is that when you were back in Florida? I know you wrestled for the I think it was Florida Championship Wrestling. Was that that before?
No, that was before. I mean, when Waylon Mercy left the WWE, it was it. I never, got back in the ring really.
Oh, that was it.
Didn't. I got operated on 2 weeks after. I got operated 2 weeks after I left.
Was that on your knee? Gotcha.
And six months after that, I had my hip replaced. I've had six hip replacements, two knee replacements, a neck fusion, 14 concussions. Other than that, I'm good.
Yeah. Other than that, your nickname's Lucky, right?
So, yeah, right.
Let me ask you, one of the guys I couldn't help remembering that you did work for, talking about promoters, you worked in the UWF under one of the most infamous promoters, our friend Herb. What can you tell us about Herb?
He was a wild man. He was a real mark. He went through all his money, trying to be a promoter. It was sad, really. I was out there in that big fiasco where they rented the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. That place held, I don't know how many people. It's a huge arena, and there's like 1,000 people sitting in the stands. It was horrible. And, it was really kind of sad, especially the way he died. I heard he died of cocaine overdose, running around Marina Del Rey in the middle of the street naked or something. I don't know. I just heard all kind of weird stories. But, he was a crazy guy.
He was one of the true characters in wrestling, Herb Abrams, in the late 80s for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, so, it's a shame, too, because there was a lot of talent in that promotion. Steve Williams was there as well, another guy that we think so highly of.
Yeah, Doc was there. Me and Doc were there. Johnny Ace was there. Brian Blair was there. There was some good talent there, and just didn't get off. He stiffed them at the MGM Grand. I don't know how that didn't turn out good. So, it was just crazy.
So I wanted to ask you, go back to Japan for one quick question that popped into my mind. You were talking about how you wish you could have worked over there your whole career, but you talked about how rough the style was, what they called the King's Road style. So that had to play a part in the shortening of your career, just how impactful all the moves were. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean it took a toll on all of us. It was stiff and. Like I said, it was almost just a tad under not real. I mean, it was pretty solid. A lot of guys come over one time, they never come back.
Yeah, exactly too. So Dan, you have lived your entire life in the Tampa region. Jeff and I are actually pretty familiar with Tampa. We get over there a couple of times a year. I vacation on Anna Maria Island twice a year, so I'm there a lot. And Jeff is a little bigger than me. He's fleshy. Jim Cornette calls him fleshy.
What up?
Yeah, I just say he's just a little bit chubby. But we both love to eat. We're coming down to Tampa. You've lived there your entire life. What's the one restaurant we have to go to in the Tampa area?
Tampa area. Well, if you like Italian, Cuban food, Colombian restaurant, Ybor City's awesome.
That's where
I would go.
We were there. We were there and we saw the flamenco dancers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I can't think of the there's a huge Burn Steakhouse is another fantastic
we were there
five-star
too.
Restaurant.
We were there too.
Well, hell, you guys, I'd be asking you where to go.
Yeah, I noticed Noble Crust. There is an Italian restaurant called Noble Crust that I've been to, and I think there's three or four locations, and it's out of this world. It's some of the best chick parm I have ever had in my life. It's fantastic.
Awesome. And that's in Tampa, correct?
It's Tampa, and there's one in St. Pete. I think there's two or three in Tampa, and I know there's one in St. Pete, and that's usually the one that I go to. But fantastic food. And then, Jeff, we always go to Portillo's. Dan, have you ever been to Portillo's?
Yes, I have. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I can't believe he's not recommending a place in Odessa.
I live further north. I live out here with the Rotundos just about. They live in Portillo.
Okay.
I live in Spring Hill, which is right next door.
All right. Well, Barry,
Scott McGee actually lives in that area as well. You ever see Scotty?
We train every morning together.
Very nice.
Oh, I guess you do. Yeah, I guess you do. Yeah. He's a good friend. He's been on our show as well. He's a good guy. But yeah, so big event coming up. It is April the 7th, which is the big WrestleMania event, Sunday, April the 7th, 2019, taking place at the Meadowlands Plaza Hotel at 40 Wood Avenue in Secaucus, New Jersey. It's marked out at the Meadowlands. You will see the reunion there of Dan Spivey and Stan Hansen, maybe one of the best tag teams to ever work the country of Japan. They'll both be there. Bob Roop is there. Tully Blanchard. Butch Reed is there. Tito Santana is there. Billy Jack Haynes. This is a loaded event. Jeff, I've mentioned it. I am going to be there. I am going to come up and see this. Dan, I want to thank you personally for the memories. So I'm going to come up, shake your hand, and hopefully you don't choke slam me because we were late today and it was all my fault.
Nah, I'll give you a break on that. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I don't do many of these things because, you know, a lot of the guys need to do them. But, you know, I've been blessed. I had three businesses that I ran. I work as a silver companion, and I just, you know, don't do them. And I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen Stan in a long time, and Tito and a lot of the guys. It's a good chance for me to see some of the boys. And I'm really looking forward to it. I get to meet you guys, and, you know, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so, Dan, we're going to leave you with the question we like to ask all of our guests. So here's the scenario. You were a guy that was always well known, dare I say, for being able to handle himself in any sort of negative situation. So let's just say you're out having an adult beverage with some of your friends, and you see a group of guys, maybe about 10 of them, and they're coming over, and they got a little bit of the old beer courage, and they want to see if you wrestlers are really tough guys. So who you got 10 guys coming at you? Who's the guy you want on your left, and who's the guy you want on your right, Dan?
Oh, gosh, let's see. Well, one that comes quickest to mind is Tonga.
That's a name that comes out quite prominently in our question.
And the other one I would say is Stan Hansen.
Okay.
If he was still alive, it would be Doc.
Okay, good choices, both of them. So, well, listen, Dan, we certainly appreciate your time going over some old wrestling memories, some old UGA football stories, too. So, go Dogs. I got a daughter that lives up just north of Atlanta. So, we really do appreciate your time, and we look forward to seeing you at the big mark out at the Meadowlands, my friend.
Yeah, you guys, please come say hello.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks, guys.
And, hey, we want to appreciate and thank Dan Spivey for his time, Barry. That was pretty great stuff, huh?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, he was a guy I like to have on again, maybe spend a little more time with him. I really enjoyed hearing what he had to say, but I'd like to hear more about like his early days of breaking in, because that seemed like that was really interesting to him, and he definitely seemed like he had some opinions on guys like Sid Vicious that maybe we could explore a little bit deeper.
Sure. So as if that's not enough, we are going to now go to our interview with the man they call the Lariat, the number one. That's right. I said it. The number one gaijin, possibly in the history of Japanese wrestling, Stan the Lariat Hansen, the bad man from Borger, Texas. Let's hear what Stan's got to say. And we are especially happy. I'm going to just flat out say it, Barry. We are honored to have a true legend of the wrestling business, Stan the Lariat Hansen, the bad man from Borger, Texas, Barry. Stan, welcome, and we're so happy to have you here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry.
Well, it's always nice to be able to talk with people that remember wrestling back in the days that I was really wrestling. So it's always nice to speak to people and dredge up some memories of a lot of the great talent I was around and anything. But I don't know if I'm a legend, but I'm really happy to where I'm at.
Well, one of the things, Barry, I know that you can tell the folks that Stan had a nice stint in Florida back in the old CWF days. Why don't you tell the folks and remind Stan about that?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And I will say, too, so Stan is going to be appearing at Mark Out at the Meadowlands. It is coming up on April the 7th at the Meadowlands Plaza Hotel between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. And it is going to be a West Texas connection there, Jeff. Not just Stan Hansen. We're going to have Tully Blanchard. Tito Santana is going to be there. Other guys appearing, good old JR, Jim Ross, Billy Jack Haynes, Butch Reed, Danny Spivey, Cowboy Scott Casey. It's absolutely a massive, huge event. I will be there. I know that a lot of our listeners are going to be there, Jeff, but I got to meet Stan, and I think this is great because I got to meet Stan about 6 weeks ago when he came into Philadelphia, and you know, I get to meet a lot of wrestlers, Jeff, just you know, the same as you do. We get to meet a lot of the boys. Stan was one of the friendliest guys I have ever met, and I put down a program in front of him from 1973 where Stan was wrestling a guy by the name of Two-Ton Tony Nero, and Stan was having a blast because he's telling me about Tony Nero, but then he's given me a tour of the entire card, and he's going to tell me everybody he was working with, and I got to say, it was just a great experience. So get a chance, Mark Out at the Meadowlands. Stan is a really friendly guy. I know he would love to meet you. But Stan, your time in Florida in 1973, it looks like it was a couple of months that you got to spend there, this was fairly early in your career. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I started January 1st, 73, and in Amarillo territory, and back then they traded out some talent, so I think it was around 6 or 7 months after working in Amarillo, they sent me down to Florida, and they worked with Eddie Graham, Dory Sr. and him had a good relationship, evidently. And the Funks, both Terry and Dory, you know, went in and were big cards down there in, you know, in the Florida. But anyway, yeah, so I went in there as the underneath guy and, you know, starved, but learned a lot and really enjoyed meeting some, you know, unique talent. Tony Nero was just one of them, you know.
Is there anybody that you specifically remember as being someone that really helped show you the way and you know, maybe on one of those car trips really gave you some of the FYI for your information stuff that you kept with you?
Oh, well, let me think, you know, I'm trying to bring up a couple of old timers names that really did good, you know, that kind of showed me around a little bit, but, you know, Robert Fuller was, you know, working there, Tony Charles from England. He was a junior heavyweight guy that was really off the charts. He was a great, great talent and could really do stuff. And, Mike Graham and Steve Kern and I ended up, kind of teaming up a little bit before he teamed up with Mike Graham later. But Steve and I had a chance to, you know, work as a tag team a number of times. And I got to meet Steve's dad, who was a POW for 7 years. And what a great honor that was to meet Steve's dad. And anyway, but yeah, there's a lot of good talent and, around there. And I can't... I was learning every day. Oh, I got to work with Johnny Valentine, you know, yeah. On television, you know, of course he beat me up pretty quick and everything.
But I was going to say Johnny's well known for his light touch in the ring, Stan. I'm sure you didn't remember that.
Yeah. He actually, you know, he said, now lay him in. And I mean, lay him in. I said, well, I was pretty green anyway. And so, anyway, when it came for me to give him a punch, I punched him. And I mean, I hit him just about as hard as I could because he told me to. And And he took a couple of steps back and said, "Beautiful baby." You know, typical Johnny Valentine. I mean, Valentine, you know. So anyway, a lot of good memories.
And you had a nice little run. And I think after you left Florida, is that when you went out to the McGurk territory and teamed up with Frank Goodish?
No, no, that was later. But what I did was I went to back to Amarillo for a while. And then I went to Oklahoma and Louisiana and worked for McGurk. And Grizzly Smith was the booker. And Leroy was running, you know, from it was 700 miles from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Houma, Louisiana. And they run on Sunday and Monday night. So that, man, we put some miles in a car, you know, through the, and they weren't freeways back there either.
So, yeah, probably exchanging cars about every 6 months, I'm guessing, huh?
Well, I mean, you could burn one out. All right. That's true. You know, Brody, that's where I did get hooked up with Frank Goodish, you know, and later changed his name to Brody he never drove a car. he was smart. He never took a car to a territory and just hitched rides. That was the way he did it, and paid people trans and so forth. So,
I was going to say, I hope he at least gave you some trans money for that. You're doing all the driving.
Yeah. We did. So, we both went to West Texas. See, so we had met a few times. He was 3 years older than me. And was, you know, only there for about a year that I was at West Texas. But, you know, we had that connection. And so, you know, in Louisiana, it was kind of a natural thing for us to be together. He had broke in with for Fritz Von Erich in Dallas territory. And I broke in with the Funks in Amarillo. So anyway, we were together. And we were big, dumb, and we were really crazy.
Well, you know, at this point, let me just mention, Stan, our producer, Lou Kippelman, has reminded us that your book, The Last Outlaw, which, by the way, is a great wrestling book. It's available through crowbarpress.com and our friend Scott over there. But getting back to on the road. So you told me when we had dinner, I reminded Stan before we started recording here that we had dinner a couple of years ago in Fort Lauderdale, and you had reminded me of the guy that was really one of the sparks of your career, because he was the guy that tipped Bruno off about Stan Hansen working there. I think his name was Mike. What was his last name again?
Yeah, Mike Peduces.
That's it.
He was from Steubenville, Ohio. Was a good friend of Bruno, but also he worked all around there, you know, in the old WWF territory. He was living in Dallas. And he was basically out of the business at the time, but he still came around the wrestling matches, and he was like a fishmonger. He sold fish to different stores, you know. So, but anyway, he saw me and he says, "God, man, you need to get up there and work with Bruno." And I said, "Well, of course, I'd love to, you know, go work with Bruno, because he was one of the top guy in the Northeast for sure, if not in the whole country." And, so anyway, he went back there and talked to him, and evidently that started the ball rolling. You know, Bruno called me, and then I guess he called Vince, and Vince called me. So, you know, it all started with Mike Peduces, and I always really respected him and thanked him every time. I didn't get to see him a whole lot after that, but he was quite a guy.
Yeah, and if I'm correct, too, in your WWE Hall of Fame speech, I believe you thanked Mike Peduces.
Don't ask me what I said, because, you know, I can't, you know, I talk off the top. You know, nowadays they give you some kind of a script to read almost verbatim. And, you know, I've always been able to talk off the top of my head, and I could never follow, you know, some kind of, it's just word for word the way somebody wants. I could say it the way I wanted to say it. And you know what? Most times it was probably better, I think. But
Yeah, anyway. There's a lot of guys of your generation that I just can't see being handed a script and having, you know, being told, here, go ahead and read this Terry Funk or Bruiser Brody. I don't think that would work too well.
Yeah, I guess not. We might not have been smart enough to do that. So, you know, that's all right.
Yeah, I'll if you hear any kids in the background, that is Stan has got his grandkids with him. And Stan, I got to ask too, are you teaching the grandkids the lariat? Are they learning the lariat at this stage?
No, they're girls and they are.
Okay. There you go. So one of my, and this was a match that I saw live. This would have been 1983. I was visiting someone in Columbus, Ohio, and I happened to see, I think it was at the Ohio Center, the Columbus Center, and it was NWA, I guess it was World Championship Wrestling on tour, and it was you and Ole Anderson in a street fight in the main event, and I was just blown away as you two guys were just beating the hell out of each other. And you and Ole had a long relationship, you know. Your run in Georgia, I think, is something that, you know, that was a real highlight at the late 70s and then early 80s. But I remember this match and just watching you two, and Frank Goodish, Bruiser Brody, was on that card as well. But what were your memories of working with a guy like Ole? He's got a reputation. He's known in the circles as being very tough, but obviously one of the greatest minds in professional wrestling.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, he was a great booker, I thought. And, you know, he had a great team, and him and Gene, and I guess Lars for a while, Anderson, but Gene Anderson and him had huge success in the Carolinas. And then Ole was booking in Georgia, and, you know, he called me in, and I thought he was really good. I mean, he had Atlanta on fire for Jim Crockett. I mean, Jim Barnett. And then later he was booking both Charlotte and Atlanta, you know. So, but yeah, I thought Ole was a great partner, and he was a really good opponent too. And I mean, I really enjoyed it. And he was a smart guy. I mean, like he said, a lot of people don't like him because he'd tell it like he said he thought it. And you know, a lot of people can't handle that. But right or wrong, you know, that's the way he did it.
Well, Stan, let me ask you, you know, as popular and as well known as you were here in the States, you really were just a megastar over in Japan. So we had talked very briefly before about when you went up and you began your program with Bruno. Now, when you're up in the WWF the first time, working with Bruno, is that where you first got introduced with the possibility of going to Japan? Was it through Vince McMahon Sr.?
Well, no, I'd gone to Japan one time.
You know, the Funks booked for Giant Baba, but Vince booked for
Inoki
and New Japan. So after I finished up in New York in 76, he booked me to a couple of tours for New Japan and Inoki, and that's how I got into it. Go over there.
So when you're over in New Japan, no, that's okay. You're working over there, and I remember the story that you told me at dinner was you realized how tenuous your position was in New Japan when one night Abdullah the Butcher came walking into the dressing room, and that's when perhaps you got interested in things over in All Japan. So could you just tell us of that whole process where you showed up in the final night of the All Japan Tag Tournament, very famous event in Japanese wrestling history, and sort of the mechanizations of what went on with you and the negotiations with Baba? And I believe you said it was Terry Funk that helped facilitate those negotiations. Am I correct?
Yeah, pretty much so, I guess. But, you know, the thing is, they were pushing. I was really getting a great push, and, you know, they promoted me well, and I was doing real good. And actually Hulk Hogan was there before he went back to Minnesota and
became a, you know, huge star. And he was there, and they were kind of pushing him a little bit too. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden, you know, we felt like we were in the right positions. And all of a sudden they bring Abdullah from All Japan over, and it was just a huge deal. And I can remember we looked at each other and said, wow,
you know, where in the heck do we stand, you know? So anyway, but it, so then later on, Terry Funk, who actually broke me into the business, contacted me and asked me if I might be interested. And I said, well, I'm interested in talking. And I mean, I had a meeting with Baba and, you know, we worked out some stuff and, that was 25 years.
I worked for him for 25 years on a handshake and, that's the kind of guy he was. So, you know,
yeah, we've always heard Stan that Baba was probably the fairest promoter that you could deal with in the business. Would that be pretty accurate?
Well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, he is. I got along good with the Noki too, though. And, that office, I never ever, you know, it was just business. It was a business deal. And, you know, they didn't hold it personal and I didn't hold it personal. And,
you know, we have a relationship to this day with the Noki and, Mr. Shima and those guys, you know, so, you know, But Baba and Terry Funk, those are the ones that I really enjoyed.
Okay, so Stan, I'm going to throw it to Barry now because I know that Barry has waited for this moment for a while because, you see, Barry is perhaps on all the podcasts in all the world, the world's biggest Jumbo Saruta fan, and I know Barry has got some Jumbo Saruta questions for you.
Yeah. Wow. I knew this was coming too. So what Jeff just said was accurate. So I only, you know, sadly, I only saw Jumbo wrestle live twice. But that being said, it's through the magic of YouTube and tape trading some 20 years ago, I have seen what I would assume, you know, as far as recorded matches, the majority of Jumbo's career through the magic of video and things, you know, being on the internet on YouTube. So Jumbo Saruta, because I'm such a huge fan, and some of the matches that you had with Jumbo to me are some of the greatest matches in the history of professional wrestling. And I'm an old guy. I've been watching since 1971. You know, so how would you give me your favorite memories of Jumbo?
Well, you know, Jumbo was he was the Japanese Olympic champion in Greco-Roman as a heavyweight and went to the 72 Olympics. And then so he ended up getting into professional wrestling in 1973 through Giant Baba. And Baba sent him to Amarillo at the exact same time that I was getting broke in. So Jumbo and I ended up working, you know, working out together, going to the gym together, riding up and down the road a little bit.
There's actually a photo that's been out there on Twitter and Facebook of you and Jumbo and around 1973 when you both broke in at approximately the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they sent him to Amarillo to train with the Funks, because the Funks were actually booking for Giant Baba. And so anyway, yeah, we were there at the same time. And you mentioned Scott Casey was also there about that time and was getting, I think he was probably broke in a little bit earlier. But anyway, yeah, Jumbo, what a great talent. You know, deceptionally strong. He could bench more, not so much in weight maybe, but he could do it longer. You know, he could do reps. He was a really strong guy and a great athlete.
So one of the things I was thinking about your career in Japan, you know, you and Brody, your run as a tag team, although it was just legendary and you guys were such a true force, it really wasn't a long run. And when I was looking back at your career, I realized just how many different guys, you know, Ted DiBiase, Terry Gordy, Genichiro Tenryu, you had a lot of different partners, Dan Spivey, a lot of different partners. So other than Brody, who do you remember as being your favorite tag team partner that you really thought you guys clicked?
I have to say Brody, you know, I mean, I want to say, because it's the truth. I mean, we were in a unique position there for about 3 or 4 years. It was, I mean, we ran roughshod over Japan, and Japan didn't like it. And there was literally a fight going on in the ring, you know, between the Japanese talent, because they didn't want to lay down. Jumbo wasn't going to lay down. And of course, Baba was at the end of his deal, but you know, he was the boss, but he wanted us to do our style. And we ended up doing that and really establishing it. And then the Funks were there, and they weren't going to take a second hand to Brody and Hanson, guys that were younger than them and also went to the same school. So, you know, it was really a competitive deal, but,
one of the things, Stan, is, you know, as All Japan evolved from the 80s into the 90s. And of course you were still there as a headliner, and guys like Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, Taue, when they started becoming the main eventers, they came up with a style that came to be called King's Road style. Can you see the genesis of the King's Road style and the stuff that you and Brody and the Funks and Saruta were doing in the 80s?
Well, I don't know. You know, I guess so. You know, all those guys, you know, Baba kept me in a good position after Brody had left and everything. And, you know, they went through Yatsu and some Japanese on Japanese stuff. And then, you know, Misawa ended up leaving and taking a bunch of the guys to form a new company. And so Baba, all he had was Misawa, Kawada, and, you know, Kobashi. And so he was there, and he expected me, and I was able to stay involved by taking on these guys, younger guys, like the next generation of Japanese guys. And I fought them tooth and nail, but when they got over me, the people, and they all got over me eventually, but man, I made them work hard. And we had some great, great matches. But when they finally got over me, the people believed in them, and they were established as top guys.
Sure. It makes the fans appreciate the effort that the guys put into it and finally, you know, getting over you.
Right. I guess so, you know. But, Baba was smart. You know, he was a smart guy. He didn't say a whole lot, but he was a smart guy, and he knew what made things click in Japan.
Gotcha. So our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, checking in here, he has a question. He says, in your book, Stan, you say that you're a big baseball fan at heart, today obviously being opening day, but that you decided to pursue a football over baseball career because of the pure physicality of it. So Lou wants to know, do you have a favorite team, and do you have a World Series prediction?
Well, my dad was from Brooklyn, and during World War II, he moved out to Texas and met my mom. So I was always a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And then when they moved to L.A., I mean, I stayed with the Dodgers. So I'd have to say that the Dodgers over time is my favorite team. And, you know, so I was actually watching them a little while ago about their opening day game. You know, they were bouncing around to four or five different games, but that's what I was watching. But, you know, I chose football because I was probably better at football than I was baseball. So, you know, I like football, and I was a good football player for, you know, back then when you were, I mean, a senior, I was like 195, but you know, that's the way it was. So, you know, but so, I got a little bit bigger in college. And then, you know, after I got out of college, I got up a little higher, you know.
And you spent some time with the Baltimore Colts in their camp, didn't you?
I did. I went up there as a free agent to Baltimore the year after they won the Super Bowl. And again, I mean, I wrote this in the book, but I got to snap the ball to Johnny Unitas, who was my all-time, I mean, he was my favorite player ever, you know, and when I was growing up, you know, and here I was in camp with the guy, and you know, it's just what an honor that was.
Yeah, no pressure on that snap, huh?
Yeah, and I snapped it early a couple of times too, and he didn't like it.
So, Barry, you got another question?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So we were talking about Giant Bob, and we had Danny Spivey. We actually had a chance to speak with Danny a couple of days ago, and Danny pretty much said Giant Bob, handshake, what everybody, there's a consistency where everybody basically says that. But what about your experiences in the States? You know, take out, say, Ole or Jim Barnett, but I know that you spent time in Memphis, and you obviously were a former AWA World's Heavyweight Champion. How is it dealing with somebody like Vern Gagne after dealing with Giant Baba for so many years?
Well, they're two different people, obviously, you know. But, you know, Vern and I butted heads almost from day one, but I don't have anything negative. I don't talk negative about anybody that's passed away. You know, he was the head guy of the AWA, and rightfully so. You know, I mean, that was his territory and so forth. You know, I never ever thought about ever getting the heavyweight belt, but they gave it to me. But then I felt like they never really promoted me. You know, it was just like squash job here, squash job there. You know, give me Kurt Henning. You know, I mean, what a great young baby face I could go out and, or that Scott Hall before, you know, he became really big. You know, he was starting it, and they were. You know, so they were all looking for somebody to try to replace Hulk Hogan, you know. But anyway, so I did butt heads against, you know, with Vern over, you know, the direction of it. And I still had Japan, and I knew that Japan was my cup of tea, and, you know, I wasn't going to sacrifice anything. So it didn't work out between Vern and I, but, you know, we sat at the table together. You know, a number of years later at the Cauliflower Alley Club, and, you know, we let all the water run underneath, you know, the bridge. It's no big deal. So anyway, you know.
Well, let me ask you, since you were talking about, you know, how you'd wanted to work with Kurt or Scott, you when you went to WCW in 1989, you had a chance to work with Lex Luger. What are your memories of working with Lex during that run?
Well, I heard nothing but kind of negative things. You know, he's a big muscle head, and he's got a big ego and everything. But, you know, I had no problems whatsoever, man. We, you know, we got on. I thought we had some really good matches. I think him and Brody has a real famous run-in somewhere down in Orlando or something. But
and Fort Lauderdale, as a matter of fact, right where I'm from.
Well, okay. Anyway, it does. So wherever that was, but, you know, that was between him and Brody. And, you know, I mean, he was nothing but all ears and respectful to me. And I have nothing negative to say about it, you know.
Barry, I think you got one last question for Stan.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, we don't want to take up too much of Stan's time. So I'm tossing now between, but I'm going to go with a food question, Stan. So you're a guy that has traveled the world.
Dude,
so
obviously, I love food, huh?
No. Jeff is Fleshy. That's his nickname. Jim Cornette has nicknamed Jeff Fleshy. But no, you have traveled the world. You spent so much time in Japan, but you wrote about Japanese cuisine in your book. And I remembered that because it resonated with me. So if I said to you, Stan Hansen, I have a jumbo jet, I have an unlimited bank account, neither of which are even remotely true in any form. But if they were, Stan, I'm taking you out. We're going to go out and get something to eat. What is the one restaurant in the entire world that you would want to go to?
In the entire world?
Yep, in the entire world.
It's Yumi's Restaurant.
And is that in Japan?
No, it's at my house. My wife's name is Yumi.
And, what a smart answer.
Good answer, Stan.
Genius answer,
she's the
absolutely.
Best cook of all time. She can cook it all. You know, so, she can cook fried chicken. She can cook chicken fried steak she can cook. You know, all the Japanese dishes, anything, man. She's a great cook, and she learned, of course, she can do all kinds of Japanese dishes. So, and we eat a lot of fish, and we eat a lot of Japanese dishes. I mean, probably 3/4 of them during the week are kind of Japanese style dishes. So that's good. You know, that was the main thing that got me to stay in Japan, was because I learned to go out and enjoy the Japanese cuisine and everything. Instead of chasing down a McDonald's or a Kentucky Fried Chicken, I got away from all that and went strictly Japanese. And once I learned to love the food, then staying in Japan for 25 years is easy.
Sure. Well, Stan, I just got a couple last questions before we wrap up here. One of the questions we always ask our guests that have been in the business, and I ask you this at the dinner conversation we had, and I want to see if you come up with the same answer. So, Stan, you're in a restaurant, whether it's United States or over in Japan, and you got 10 guys that have the, let's just say, the beer courage, and they're looking over and they're seeing you. You're one of those wrestlers who think they're tough guys, and they're going to come over and try to cause some problems with you. So tell me two guys that you want standing on either side of you to help you deal with this situation.
Oh, God. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, what answer would I get? There's a bunch of guys I'd like to stand by. Well, Bruiser Brody would be one of them.
Okay.
And, Terry Funk, just about the toughest SOB in the whole country. You know, I beat him so much, and he never gave in. You know, he was tough. You know, and Steve Williams, he was a good guy. I mean, there are so many guys that I was around that were really horses. So.
Well, I'll just remind you, Stan, at the dinner, we were playing a little joke on this this guy that I used to know, and we told you that he was a big fan of Terry Gordy's. So what you said was, oh, Terry would be there, but he'd be running out the back door. And you did it as a rib on the guy because he was such a Gordy fan.
Yeah, well, I don't remember that, but Terry Gordy was somebody that would, you know, he had been in a few altercations in his day.
Yeah, what a great talent he was too.
Yeah, one of the best. I mean, they were grooming him. You know, I mean, he was destined to take over. You know, for all Japan and everything, and you know, it's a sad deal. You know, but he was one of the best talent. You know, 300-pound guy. You know, like Brody and I, and a few guys are that size. You know, back then that was kind of big, but it's not so big anymore.
Sure. But, okay. Anyway. So before I ask my last question of you, we once again, Barry, why don't you plug Stan's appearance coming up here right before WrestleMania, and then I'll ask one last question.
Absolutely, too. So you can meet Stan Hansen. You can shake his hand. You can get an autograph. You can take a photo. It is Mark Out at the Meadowlands coming up on April the 7th, 2019, which is WrestleMania Sunday, taking place in beautiful downtown Secaucus, New Jersey. It is a West Texas reunion. Stan Hansen, Tully Blanchard, Merced Solis, Tito Santana, Scott Casey. Also in attendance, Billy Jack Haynes, Danny Spivey, Hacksaw Butch Reed, Shane Douglas, and good old JR, Jim Ross, plus a host of, I think there's 30 more talents there. This is going to be a huge event. Stan, I am going to come up, introduce myself, and I may even bring a pack of chaw with me to hand to you that day. But I'm real excited about this. And Jeff, you said you had one more question for Stan?
Yeah, and of course, I also do want to remind the folks that Scott Teal's Crowbar Press does still have Stan's book, The Last Outlaw, which is a terrific wrestling book, and I highly recommend it. So, here's what I'm going to leave you with, Stan. Same question I left you with at the dinner table that night in Fort Lauderdale a couple of years ago. Of course, you're really famously linked with your friend Frank Goodish. And there have been so many questions and stories about Frank that have been asked. So I'd like you, as we end our little interview here with you, tell the folks about your friend Frank outside the ring and what you remember about him outside the ring. Not Bruiser Brody, your friend Frank Goodish. What do you remember?
Well, I mean, I got to see Frank down in San Antonio at his home with his wife Barbara and his young son Jeff, and so it, you know, that's the Brody that he had a lot of ideas and things that evidently that he was planning to do to help out kids and do a lot of things to give back in that San Antonio area. And of course it, his life was, you know, cut short and it never happened. But, you know, to me, that's the possibility of what he was hoping to do in that situation and going forward. I think that really tells the real Brody. You know, a lot of the guys, you know, Stan Hansen, you know, when I take off my glasses and the bell rings, you know, then, you know, I do become Stan Hansen the wrestler. But, you know, the rest of the time, I'm, you know, you can't be that character all the time when you're walking around, and Brody couldn't be Bruiser Brody all the time either. So, you know, I'd love to see Frank today. You know, he often said, I started in the opening match. I'm going to keep wrestling until I'm in the first match of the card again.
Stan, that's great stuff. I do want to say that Barry, on behalf of Barry and myself, we certainly do appreciate your time. We hope that the folks will come out to the mark out at the Meadowlands. And
I hope everybody comes out. We didn't get to talk about West Texas a lot, but Marced Solis, you know, Tito Santana, he was the guy that I coached him as a freshman kid at West Texas, and, you know, went on to become just a huge star, great guy. And, you know, Tully Blanchard and, Kelly Konitsky. I mean, you can name off. I mean, there's so many guys, you know, and Dick Murdoch, even though he didn't go to West Texas, we have to say that he's an honorary.
And you're forgetting Ted DiBiase.
Yeah, Ted DiBiase, of course. And, sure. You know, like you said, Tully and Manny Fernandez is another guy, you know, and Bobby Duncan. You know, big Bobby Duncan, yeah. You know, I mean, what a great talent he was. And he influenced me a lot in a great style, too. So, you know, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about West Texas a little more. I was hoping to. But anyway, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So once again, Stan, thanks so much for your time. We do appreciate it. And we'll be talking to you down the road.
Okay. Thanks. See you in New York.
And boom, how cool is that? Stan the Lariat. Barry, I'm going to go out and say it. I think Stan may have been our biggest name guest yet. And that's saying something because we've had Dory Funk Jr. on here.
Yeah, who do we get next?
I don't know. You know, I got a call from this guy named Hogan, and he said, I want some time. And I said, I'll see if I can fit you in, brother.
There you go.
Brother. So, hey, brother. So, yeah, but that was good stuff. Always fun talking to Stan. It's the second time I've had a chance to talk to Stan. You know, as I mentioned in the interview, I've had a chance to have dinner with Stan before, and he was really, really a good guy and very nice. And we really do appreciate his time. So Barry,
Jeff, I want to interrupt you. So you had dinner with Stan Hansen. Is there any record of this dinner anywhere?
Perhaps there might be. I'm thinking there was a book somewhere. Yes, I think a book available through our good friend Scott Teal at Crowbar Press. Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Wrestler, the Legends of Wrestling, written by yours truly. Barry, that's a nice little plug. I do appreciate that.
Absolutely. So this is where it all began. It's and I should say, too, because I put up that video today, which you saw, of Steamboat that you recorded some 4 or 5 years ago, of Steamboat thanking the fans of CWF for keeping the memories alive. And I'm using that to plug my own fan fest. But that Stan Hansen dinner, the interview that you did with him was fantastic. So where can people get this book, Jeff?
It's available at crowbarpress.com. Scott Teal is the publisher. Yes, absolutely. We encourage. still paying off the last remains of that wedding from October, Barry. So thanks for pointing that out. So, Barry, you're out ready for the go home here?
I think this is it.
Yeah. So we will be back next week. We will have again our match of the week. We also have our movie review of the week. And we appreciate the patience. I'm sure we're not going to hear anything about the fact we delayed them this week, Barry. But we'll be back with regular stuff next week. So until then, I will thank all of you and encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Sweet Lou Kippelman on the production duties, as always. We do appreciate your efforts, Lou. Until next week, we will talk to you.